My name is Natalie Nixon. I'm from the United States. I'm an associate professor in the Fashion Management program and director of a newly launched Strategic Design MBA program. And thank you very much, Alan, for your remarks. It really is some wonderful segues into some of the things I'd like to talk about. Maybe in some variation of what I had first thought when I was invited to come speak, but we'll see how this goes, and I really welcome your thoughts and your feedback. So thank you very much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here. And I decided to call my talk The Creative Dedicated Minority, Design Management's Present State. So I was asked to speak about the present state of design management. As you know, the theme of this conference is design management, past, present, and future. So I'd like to start with a story, a rather personal story. That's me. That's me back in 1978 when I was 8 years old. I was bright-eyed, curious, eager, about to start a new school. And the only thing about that change was that I would be integrating that school in a lot of ways. And I would be the first and only black child, African-American child, in the class. Just to highlight that point. The only one. So what was really interesting about that experience for me is that at age nine actually, because I started in the fourth grade there, at a really young age, I had to learn to be a translator. I had to learn to be very observant. I had to learn to be in it and not of it. I had to learn how to negotiate being on the margins. And what's interesting is that 1 week ago today, literally a week ago exactly today, in the United States, specifically in Washington, D.C., we celebrated the 50th year anniversary of the March on Washington. So what you're looking at is a photograph of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. in 1963. And just kind of take in that image for a minute. It's an image that some of us have seen pretty regularly, and we might even take for granted, but that's a pretty awesome moment from his vantage point. And that was some, I don't know, little over 10 years before I entered the fourth grade. And yet I was still faced with some of the issues that this civil rights struggle was all about. And contrasted with that image, and what really came to the fore last Wednesday, is the fact that we had this 50th year anniversary celebration of the March on Washington, and an African American man is president of the United States, President Barack Obama. So it's pretty amazing. So you're probably wondering, okay, what does that have to do with design management? Well, I'm doing a bit of an exercise in something in design thinking we call related worlds, the opportunity to understand how we might connect the dots between seemingly irrelevant, seemingly unrelated areas and sectors and realms. And certainly, my personal experience integration is not narrowed down to the African-American experience in the United States. It might be something that has some parallels to Turks in Germany, or to Tamils in Sri Lanka, or to women in a predominantly male working environment. And I'm certainly not standing here today to say that the historic racial, social, civic struggle of the United States is equivalent to some of the struggles of design management. But I submit there are some parallels, and there are some really important things that we can learn from the two. So in order to prepare for my remarks, I'm a qualitative researcher. I actually studied with Alison Riepel at University of Westminster. That's where I did my doctorate in design management. She trained me well, and I decided to go out into the field. And I asked a series of practitioners, and I know that this is primarily an academic conference, but I think it's very important that our academic work is informed by practice and by practitioners. So I went out and I interviewed a number of design managers and practitioners who work with design managers. And I'm highlighting some of the learnings that surfaced from specifically about seven of them. And the three major things that came to the fore for me were the importance of integration in design, designers' work and design management today. Secondly, the role of ownership and what ownership means, and the role of politics and power and negotiation in ownership of this discourse of design and design management. And thirdly, language. I put up a key as my symbol for language. I studied anthropology as an undergraduate, and one of the first things you learn when you study linguistics, for example, is that when you know a people's language, you understand their worldview and the way that they navigate the world. Did anyone happen to come across this article back in March 2013? I want to, before I go into my data from my small sampling, I want to kind of talk about the tone of the discussions around design, business design, design thinking, design management. The title of this article is "Should Designers Fear Design Thinking MBAs?" It was published in March 2013 in Co-Design, a Fast Company. And it's authored by Brian Gillespie. And Brian is a principal partner at Continuum Design in Massachusetts. And he used to head up digital strategy for Continuum. I believe he was probably educated here in the UK at Westminster, earned his MBA at Westminster. But it's a really provocative title. Love the photograph. And outsiders might think, gee whiz, that's a really strong word, fear. Should designers fear design thinking MBAs? And if you haven't read the article, I really encourage you to. And one of the things that's probably even more fascinating are all the comments after the article. That's the part I often like to read. The short answer, Brian's short answer, is no. You shouldn't fear design thinking MBAs. But it's really significant that what's surfacing in our popular culture are these realities of this angst that a lot of designers feel as we attempt to become more integrated and integrative. So why this emphasis on fear? Well, I decided to go out and test out these observations that I've been having with these practitioners. So I'm going to just share with you who I met with, who I spoke with. Harold Hambros is the CEO and founder of Electronic Ink. Electronic Ink is a user interface design firm based in Philadelphia. One of the things I highlighted that he said is that the designer's job is to make the process transparent, inviting, and inclusive. I'm just going to move over here so I don't keep looking back. And what I really would like to highlight about his comment is this importance of transparency. And I'm going to talk in a little bit about what I perceive as a bit of a veil that has been lifted away from design and a veil that's been lifted a bit away from business. I also met with and interviewed Valerie Jacobs. And Valerie Jacobs and I have become fast friends and colleagues. We're working on a fashion thinking project. If you'd like to learn more about that, please ask me. I'm working on that with Valerie and Johanna Blakely. But one of the things that she said that I highlighted was the statement that we designers struggle with the ROI of design. We struggle with the return on investment of design. And the reason why I've highlighted that particular comment is because it really helped me to think about what's the value? What's the perceived value of design? And what's the real value? How do you assign metrics to the value of design? Is it actually possible? I also interviewed Jennifer Merchant. And Jennifer is an associate director in the personal healthcare business at Procter & Gamble. This is a comment that she made. We are a link between communicating strategy and consumer knowledge. And what I love about that comment is immediately the visual that I had was this idea that designers and design managers are this bridge. And I'll talk more about that. Keith Scandone is a partner at O3, which is a digital media design firm in Philadelphia as well. I was really interested in talking to Keith because Keith is not a designer. He has a background in marketing and advertising. He works with a lot of designers. He works with a lot of UX designers. He works with a lot of graphic designers. He works with design managers. Something that he said is that the more diverse the team from the beginning, the better. And that was something for him that was newfound knowledge and realization. I also interviewed Bob Schwartz. Bob is the general manager for global design and user experience at GE Healthcare. He's a real dynamo. He has amazing sound bites that just come out of his mouth all the time. And he said, for example, bottom line, I clear weeds, I lay pipe, I am a diplomat. And he had some really enlightening things to share about, based on his long tenure, straddling that bridge between design and business. Janine Spence is a senior program manager at Microsoft, and she's had the unpopular challenge, emphasis on challenge, of being a designer who's tasked with teaching design thinking to teams of engineers at Microsoft. And she has some wonderful things to say, including this point, that managing for diverse points of view has become really significant and important. And Surya Vanka, who's director of user experience at Microsoft, who emphasized over and over emphatically that designers have to own it. Designers have to own their value, have to own what it is that they're contributing, and have the confidence to challenge. And he really put out there that one of the limitations in design education as compared to business school education is that designers do not tend to be educated for leadership specifically. If they trip upon it, great. But to really have that in the forefront as a goal is pretty rare. So I did these series of interviews. I also browsed social media because I was very interested in what is the public conversation like among designers, between designers, about designers. And so I looked at, excuse me, for example, Pinterest, LinkedIn, and Twitter. So some of the things that really surfaced to me about a site like Pinterest is that it really showed a sense of humor that designers and design managers have, which I think is really important and very refreshing. Obviously, this shows that design management offers a space to visually communicate and visually represent some complex ideas, and therefore makes the work that we do much more accessible. The other thing that was highlighted in some of the Pinterest entries was that it was also a platform to highlight a lot of the scholarship, because at this stage, we actually do have a significant amount of contribution to the field of knowledge that is used in some ways on these types of social media sites. Sites such as LinkedIn have become professional networking organizations. They've become venues and forums for discussion, for debate, for setting up the next job interview. So they have very practical application as well as a space for very philosophical conversation. In Twitter, one of the things that at least some of the Twitter groups that I'm a member of, one of the avenues that design management has gone into is social innovation and social entrepreneurship, service design, and public policy. Also, what's interesting, speaking of policy, is design's role in influencing policy. So for example, now the World Economic Forum has a global agenda council on design and innovation. And one of the things, some of the things that they've highlighted are the ways that design can innovate policy, the ways that design can innovate urbanization, the ways that design can innovate education, how design education is being influenced by innovation. And I think we're all aware of now the opportunities for cities to nominate themselves to be considered as world design capital. So Helsinki has been a world design capital, Seoul, South Korea has been a world design capital, and Cape Town is a future world design capital. What I think is really interesting about these types of spaces is that it shows the greater opportunity and breadth and of application of design management. So once again, the three themes that really surfaced were those about integration, ownership, and language. So let's talk first about the first theme, integration. So what was really apparent to me and through these interviews and through mining these social media websites was that designers and design managers are kind of in this holonic space. They are both building bridges and they are bridges in and of themselves, which can create some levels of complexity, frustration, and just downright being hard to do sometimes. The other thing that this theme of integration brought out is that designers have to be meta designers. And so what I mean by that is people like Bob Schwartz, Serdia, Harold. Some of the things they kept saying is that, you know, designers have to operate and execute some of these design thinking principles, such as empathy, when they are meeting with business leaders. They completely somehow freeze and throw that out the window and aren't actually exercising those types of principles. So the idea to be self-aware enough and apply on a meta level the principles that make us distinctive in our practice is really essential. So, one of the things I'd like to be very clear about, and something I certainly learned if I didn't learn it when I was 9 years old, I certainly learned it throughout high school, is that integration is not assimilation is not the same thing as integration. And often, too frequently, we confuse assimilation for integration. So what do I mean by that? Assimilation is a one-way street. Integration is a two-way street. Integration requires curiosity on both sides, on both partners about the other. Integration requires commitment. It requires communication and dialogue. So if the assimilator is always in a role, in a position of learning about the other, translating for the other and from the other, and figuring out how to navigate, that is not integration yet. And that's certainly something in my earlier first personal story example, what the United States has struggled with even up until now, quite frankly. And I developed this following schema after a conversation with Bob Schwartz, where he mapped out what I thought was a brilliant way for me to explain in the design management context these differences between assimilation versus integration. So if we plot integration over time, we have some really iconic moments of how design actually is or is not integrated or assimilated into an organization. So kind of the early stages, design and design management is treated as eye candy. It's a slap some pink on it type of strategy. It's we're done, and what can you groovy designers come in and do? It's an afterthought. So that's the very early stage. That certainly is not integration. That is assimilation. The second stage is designers as influencers, right? So they can make a splash. They might be invited to a meeting or two, but they're not necessarily brought in at the very beginning. Maybe they're brought in at the end and probably not really given public credit. That's still not integration. Then we get to the point where designers, design managers are collaborators, right? And partners. So this is a little better. And this, frankly, is where a lot of mainstream companies that we think of as offering great design are. The real goal, which is at the truly integrative moment in the history and lifespan of a company, is when design and design management is part of the DNA of an organization. So Apple, the usual suspects are kind of at this stage, right? And that has everything to do with leadership. So Harold Hambros of Electronic Inc. made this comment, which I think is really significant. He said, if I move as many disciplines as possible through the process, I'll get much richer problem definition. So Harold was trained as an industrial designer, and he told me that one of the things that a big shift for design managers is that they have to learn how to manage the other. And when you are required to work with the other, those who have a very different background, discipline, lens, worldview than you, number one, you have to be very clear and self-aware about what you're bringing to the table in order to understand what the added value is. And so one of the things he shared with me is that when he first started his practice, he hired designers, anthropologists, psychologists, MBAs, and everybody got the role of designer. And one of the things that's, and everyone loved that to a point. And one of the things that points out is that there really is a cool factor with design that can't be underestimated, right? And that's part of the thing that people want a piece of. But then the designers are kind of like, yeah, I don't know if I really like this that much. I mean, I have been trained with technical expertise as a designer. So what began to happen is they parceled out the title and naming of design so that there were design researchers, right? And there were user experience designers, et cetera. This comment was in response to a question that I asked Jennifer Merchant. I asked every person who I interviewed, but I loved what Jennifer said. I asked, what do you say to designers who have their hands on their hips and are really upset that this design thinking thing is taking off, who feel like they don't have a seat at the table? And she said, well, in my view, that integration elevates design. It doesn't mean that we don't have a seat at the table. It means that now we're part of the conversation. Other people I interviewed had a little more ruder responses. I'll politely say they said, get over it. But I thought that this was a really wonderful, poetic way of talking about a flipped way of understanding this integration. A lot of the integration discussions also dialed back to the role of education. And this is a big takeaway about design schools versus business schools. So kind of a theme around some of the challenges the design schools are facing is that a lot of design schools are graduating students who are fascinated with the artifact and not the path to it. And I attribute that to Harold Hambros, right? So completely enraptured with this thing, this object that I want to, if I'm an industrial designer, want to be able to go off and make 1 million units of, or this dress if I'm in fashion design that I spent so much time with construction detail and technical design, or we could go on and on, right? But for design education to be able to teach that level of craft and technical skill as well as the understanding of the path to that, because that's the translatable part. That's the part that's transferable to scientists, to engineers, to policy workers. The other thing that surfaced about the limitations of business school is that business schools are not really equipped to apply and scale the design process, right? So by scaling design process, we're saying, okay, so now you think you're a design thinker. You've learned the basic steps and methodologies involved with design thinking. Well, how do you apply that in 5 days versus how do you apply that over 5 months? How do you even apply it in very different contexts? And these kinds of ideas and criticisms I really took to heart because of the strategic design MBA we've launched at Philadelphia University. I really want to be sure that in our attempt to bridge these traditional silos in academia, we really make sure we can undo and redo some of this criticism. So the second theme around ownership. So a big takeaway for me was that a lot of the struggle about who owns design, who owns the conversation about design thinking, design management, is really about there's been a veil that's been removed. And when the veil's been removed from the face of design, i.e. through the process of design thinking, all of a sudden, design has become much more accessible to a wider range of people, which is part of the conversation that Brian Gillespie was unveiling in his Fast Company article about the fear. Congruently, at the same time, the veil has also been pulled away from business, right? So all of the convoluted algorithms and too complex financial operations and statements that no one could penetrate are actually quite accessible from a number of different angles. So this veil is being drawn away from several directions. So Jadine shared that when we started actively teaching design thinking to the engineers at Microsoft, designers were really threatened, which surprised us. Now, she's a designer, remember, and she was really surprised that designers would be so threatened with this idea of the veil being removed, of a broader span of people owning what design is. I did a bit of reading to try to understand from a philosophical level, what are we really talking about when we talk about ownership? And so I read this long-ish essay, about 80 plus pages, by Robert Lefebvre. I think I'm pronouncing his last name correctly. And he talks about the philosophy of ownership. And he talks even more specifically about the ownership of the intangible, which was something I was interested in. Now, I will say with full disclosure that Robert Lefebvre was a libertarian. I don't share his politics. He was also a pacifist. I share that a bit more. But despite whatever his political inclinations and political philosophies, I thought he had some interesting things to teach me from his point of view about the philosophy of ownership. And one of the things he talks about is that once we share ideas, as we're opening up who owns an idea, who owns a process, who owns a space, he said it's a bit like emptying water out of a bucket. And so when you empty water out of a bucket, there's still little droplets of water left, and yet the boundaries of the idea have expanded. The other thing he pointed out, which was really helpful to me, is that ideas are constituted, ideas are constituted by multiple things. So in other words, no idea is truly new. And he also talked about the fact that all sharing is predicated on ownership. So in order to share something, we first have to own it. What even better outcome if a multitude of people are owning it? So this is a photograph of Nathan Hendricks. Nathan Hendricks is the creative director at LPK, a branding firm in Ohio, in the United States. And this is just a screenshot of a talk that he gave recently on something he calls the fourth estate, design as the fourth estate. Now, you may be familiar with this, with the ideas around the fourth estate. The fourth estate is typically thought of as an institution in society which is not credited for being very influential. Usually the fourth estate is considered the media. And what Nathan put forth is that the fourth estate is actually design, and that design is not really credited for the influence that it has. What was really interesting about his talk is that it kind of hones in on this feeling of angst and this tone of angst that is very alive in the design conversation. And I like this statement, Bruce Mal's manifesto. He quotes something from Leonard Cohen, that this idea of there being a division, a dichotomy between the suits and the creatives is a charming artifact of the past. There's no such dichotomy anymore. We have to move on beyond that. And I think there's a lot, actually, that in this whole conversation and discourse we can learn from fashion. So this is actually a picture of Tom Ford. And some of you may be aware that right now there's a big debate going on in the fashion space about ownership of ideas and intellectual property. So there's one camp that consists of Diane von Furstenberg, who are all about trademark and copyright and really increasing the legal barriers to entry. And that has all sorts of ramifications if you're an emerging younger designer. Tom Ford, on the other hand, is part of the camp that says, give it away. That actually helps me to be much more innovative and much more on the verge of what's new and what's next. So this philosophical stance of opening up the field, which is what we see in fashion, may be something very interesting for us to borrow from. The third theme I'll talk about is language. And so something that Janine said is that when it comes to the language, there's a couple of issues. There's language amongst designers, which we've already talked about today. But there's also the language and translation that happens between non-designers and design. And when I first started out on researching for this talk, I thought, maybe there needs to be a lingua franca. Maybe there needs to be a language construct that is a new tertiary language that intersects between business and design. After speaking with a number of people, I decided it's not probably that we don't need to complicate things that much, but really distill things to a common denominator. And so one of the things that Janine talked about is that it's less about a confusion over terms. It's more about a confusion over value and time commitment. And that's where the breakdown really happens. So I actually found some examples of how other industries are moving not to a lingua franca, but really distilling things down to a simpler common denominator. So Twyla Tharp has written a book, which I highly, highly recommend, called The Creative Habit. Valerie actually encouraged me to read it. I have read it. And one of the things that I love about this book is that she succeeds in translating the creativity to non-creatives. And she does a really good job at it, probably with the assumption that we all are at our core creative. Another good example of that translation in very simple terms is Daniel Pink's To Sell as Human, where he's going from another direction, where he's translating the value of sales and selling to people, to wide audiences, some of whom may scrunch at the idea of being considered a salesman, but he really is broadening up the conversation. Even the legal field. My husband happens to be an attorney. That is certainly a field and a profession that is bogged down by jargon that seems to be impenetrable most of the time. But even in the legal profession, there is a movement to honor and celebrate those practicing attorneys, legal rebels, they're called by the American Bar Association, who are doing things differently, who are coding the logic of law, who are integrating design thinking into law. So here's something interesting that I started to notice, is that if you squint, maybe you don't even have to squint that far, there's not a whole lot of difference in the visual representation of design thinking on the left and lean startup on the right. There seems to be, we're beginning to get to a bit of a merger. Here's another way of looking at it. This is work by Thorin and Mueller, where they're breaking down the distinctions between design thinking and lean startup. And they probably purposefully have mapped them out very similarly, but not too distinctive in the layout and the flow. I don't see a whole lot of iterative flow and loopy arrows on the left. And they took it a step further, and they said, well, what might lean design thinking look like? And so they truly integrated and the two and tried to create a visual language that shows the overlap and integration. So Bob Schwartz said, we're in this business to deliver shareholder value and improve the lives of people. There's a twofold mission and task that we have as designers. And some of you and today and others who I've talked with over the past several years talk about, well, what's the ROI of design? What's the return on investment of design? And I started to think, maybe it's not so much about asking what the ROI is. Maybe it's much more a question of understanding what the ROE is. What's the return on equity? Because if we start to shift the conversation to a return on equity, we begin to understand in very real terms that it's design which makes business visible. So some basic understandings about the difference between ROI and ROE. ROI is net income divided by investment. And it's a very external conversation. It's external influences. Return on equity is a much more internal conversation. It's net income divided by shareholder equity. So if I were to try to dissect that a little bit and break that apart, I might begin to look at the ROE, the return on equity, as being this phenomenon of making business visible, and the net income being about value and worth, and the return on equity having, the equity piece being the craft and skills and ideas the designers contribute. So one Venn diagram is always necessary. the return on equity is really this amalgamation of value, meaning, craft, skills, and ideas. To take it a step further, and I was interested to hear some others of you have had some thoughts and remarks today about sense making, I'll take it a step further and say that designers' return on equity is really about sense making, right? It's really about being able to attach meaning to what is experiential. And this is a doodle, a visualization of sense making. What I think is really interesting is how similar this looks to that, right? So here we have some interesting parallels between the design thinking visualization and sense making visualization. So what I want to leave you with, how am I on time? Great. So what I'd like to leave you with are the lessons I hope that you'll take away from this idea share that I've had with you today. Lessons on integration, co-ownership, and bilingualism, because that's really, I think, what designers and design managers are called to do and be. Number one, first lesson is it takes a really long time. and we can learn that from other examples and cases and attempts of integration. It does not happen overnight. It requires a bit of peripheral awareness. Anytime you are on the margins, you become very facile and agile at being aware of what's in front of you, what's to the side of you, and even especially very, very cognizant about what has come already. It's really essential that design managers practice meta-design and practice what they preach in these principles, especially when they are building these bridges and broaching these bridges. Positive subversion was a term that Bob Schwartz liked to use to explain his techniques and tactics for integrating tables and conversations at huge global corporations like GE Healthcare. A focus on equity, so instead of always focusing on ROI, which is a much more external conversation, beginning to understand and focus on return on equity. The essential steps that educators have to take to make sure that we are educating more enlightened people who are going to the space of business and design. The role of sense making and design managers as sense makers. And really understanding that ultimately we're going through a process of unlocking each other's potential. I wanted to end with one final story, personal story again. This is a photograph of my father. Fred Weathers. My dad died almost a year ago, November 6th, and he died of cancer. And it probably wasn't quick, but we didn't catch it early enough. So from diagnosis to when he passed away, it was 4 months. So in that first month, if any of you have had to go through this experience yourself personally, have supported those who are going through it, it's extremely horrible. It's a horrible experience to go through. It's emotional. It's confusing. Depending on your role in the dynamic, you're negotiating a lot of different actors. So one day, this is probably about his first week in the hospital, last August, we were waiting for the biopsy reports to really confirm the type of cancer he had and the stage of cancer that it was. And I have experienced that the nurses were amazing. The nurses are on the front line. They're interacting with the patient directly. They are the bridge. And I had a great conversation with the nurse. She left. I was sitting with my father. He was dozing off. And I went out into the hallway. And I saw a gentleman walking briskly down the hallway, and he stopped and started talking to the nurse. And I was waiting to ask the nurse a question, so I was standing off kind of to the side. And I heard him mention Mr. Weathers. I heard him mention kidney, liver. And because I'm the daughter, I'm a family member, I've been talking to all of these different physicians, I understood a bit of information that he was trying to get at from the nurse. So I went up to the nurse and the physician and I interrupted. I said, "Excuse me, my name is Natalie. I'm actually Fred Weather's daughter. I overheard you asking about XYZ." And he said, "Yes." He was very brusque. And I said, "Well, I happen to know about," and I began to tell him three instances that I had recently had conversations with based on conversations with my mother, conversations with two other physicians. And he brushed me off and he said, "I don't need to know any of that. All of the information I need to know is going to be on the statistics that we get from this next test." And I was just taken aback. I was also very emotional. I was very kind of hypersensitive about the whole situation. And I said, "Okay." I said, "Well, if that's the way you practice medicine, that's fine. But I think my stories are data as well." And he said, "Okay, what did you want to tell me?" Because he could tell I was getting a little upset. And I told him what I knew. But I'm just sharing that story because it really speaks to this goal that Valerie Jacobs left me with, which is that what if we could have organizations that were really built of structures of curiosity? What if we could build organizations as designers, as design managers, that really encourage integration so that the left hand knew what the right hand was doing, so that we weren't just organizations filled with specialists in silos? If we could build organizations and structures of curiosity that really valued shared ownership and co-ownership, and if we really began to share language and really take the time to hear each other. And so I leave you with this statement from Martin Luther King Jr. is actually, that's where the title of my talk comes from. One of the many, 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 many wonderful philosophical credos he left us with is this statement: "Almost always, the creative, dedicated minority has made the world better." So I hope that we, in our work, can also make the world better. Thank you.